Finance.com.
Every time you move velocity of money, your growth in an economy actually has a very positive impact. Take an example, even a stock market. Every time they cut down their transaction settlement cycle from a T plus 4 to 5 to 3 to 1 and now T plus 1, I guess, the volumes have grown. It's a very simple analogy that more digitized you do, the velocity of money increases. More velocity increases, your growth in the economy becomes faster because your money remaining ideal, the period for which it is ideal and the quantum which is ideal reduces, which means it is more productive. When it is more productive and the economy is growing, everybody will grow.
Former Managing Director, It's Cash, India's largest prepaid payments network, the Chairman of the FinTech Convergence Council, Chairman Emeritus of Payment Council of India, and a long-serving Chairman of PCI. A payments crusader and the man who made markets for electronic payments in India, from railway tickets to Amway products. Naveen Surya is a man who has been busy and kept many others busy as well. Naveen, a very warm welcome to Park Breakers.
Thank you, Pendru.
Alright, so Naveen, let me kick this off with the first question. How did it feel when that first payment went through on the It's Cash network?
Butterflies, like when you meet your girlfriend for the first time.
They were good butterflies, I'm sure.
Of course.
Okay, so how was It's Cash conceived? What was the problem it was trying to solve?
So it conceived as I was already working as a part of SL Group, which is a large media conglomerate. They were trying to solve problem for reaching digital content or a media content to large mass number of consumers. And traditionally, this was dependent only on physical cables in the country, which did not have feasibility in rural areas. So large part of country did not have access to large number of television channels. And this is where they thought that a technology like a satellite and a set-top box, which Dish TV was set up and they were the pioneer in the entire DTH industry, they were trying to solve for that content distribution. The problem, however, they were facing that if they reach rural areas, not just for their distributor, retailer, but end consumer, all three stakeholders, how would they transact about money? Because the content is being delivered real-time. You're able to do every other process through internet real-time. By those days, it's about 2006-7 we're talking about. Most of the stuff was really in there. But they were not sure how would you receive money, because the commercial transaction with consumers as well as businesses were heavily reliant on the checks. And the only other option for consumers at that time to pay digitally in a real-time was credit card, which was way handful of people those days, while it's still a handful of people. I mean, probably less than 1% that time, and now about closer to 2.5%.
Perfect.
So that's where we were asked that, can we find a solution where a payment can be received digitally across all digital channels?
Sure.
Be it internet, be it mobile phone, be it IVRS, which is a voice channel, or even SMS.
Sure.
And that was a challenge for us, that can we create that payment convergence product?
Okay.
Which can seamlessly work across these channels,
at least
to receive payment.
Excellent.
And we just simply rode off the learnings and experience of mobile phone companies, where they were already doing it as a prepaid mode.
And to give us a context, which year are we talking about?
I think this would be, the conceiving and this problem discussions was somewhere around 2006-7.
That's
where the project actually started taking shape.
Okay. So just to give us a sense, if you're looking at 2006-7 and if you're looking at today, how many debit or credit cards would have been there in 2006-7 and where are we today?
Sure. I think the debit card penetration was way lower at that time. It was more ATM cards.
Right.
So it was actually even lower than the credit card that time.
Correct.
And credit card, as I said, less than 1% of the population.
Perfect.
Which currently is now 2.5%.
So would have been a couple of million in those days?
I think it would be about 10 million or so credit card. I mean, I don't have the exact number, but approximate. Debit card today, of course, has grown very fast. I think almost 60-70% of the population now at least have a debit card.
Got it. So a prepaid card was essentially for someone who didn't have a credit card or a debit card. Is that fair?
It was actually for those, plus even those who had it, but if they wanted to do small value online transaction,
perfect.
Even they preferred to use it.
Sure.
Because again, internet was very new channel and people were still wary of it. It was very small percentage of people
correct.
Who were okay using even their credit card online.
Got it. And why was it called It's Cash?
Oh, it was simple acronym for It Is Cash. There's another story, different podcast for that.
Different podcast for that. All right. We will look forward to the next podcast as well. So ItsCash had a very colorful, interesting journey, right? Yeah. So when you exited ItsCash, how large was it?
Well, it was fairly large. I think we were the largest in our segment in terms of revenues, in terms of profitability. I think we were about close to $2 billion worth of transactions.
Wow.
And when I say this, I am talking a number which is one side, unlike many other players who multiply it by four for counting the loading and then debit and then both sides. So you should kind of...
So the actual value of money...
Debit
exchanged.
Is from the wallet, not credit and debit both. It's just the one side debit. About $2 billion worth. I think our revenues were north of 200 crores.
Wow.
And our profits were about close to 2 crores. And we were the only company which was profitable despite being in a digital retail payments.
Great. So tell me, it is a journey of more than a decade.
Yep.
Right? From concept to the time that you exited. So what are some of the key challenges that you faced in growing this business?
I think there were many. I think if I divide it broadly in a phase where there was pre-regulation and then let's say during regulations and scale up phase with regulation. So let's talk pre-regulation. I think we originally were conceived to be only a cost center. As I said, our origin was because of Dish TV and we needed to do something. So there was a time when our 100% reliance and their reliance was just on each other. Which means for us, they were the business. For them, we were the only service provider.
Correct.
But we also knew that we can't in this kind of a system. And when we started, even on that time, we had multiple services. But still the dominant volume was from Dish TV. And we realized that this has to change.
Sure.
And we have to kind of diversify and become an independent from a cost center to an independent profit center company. And that's where the challenges started, because from one particular, right from your system to team to your product design to even commercials, they had to completely change as you added more and more products. For an example, this TV model was simple sales model with a discounting model, as they say, cut and pay. When we went into other services, the model actually became commission oriented. So you had to actually disburse commission as the transaction happens. Now, it looks like a one line, but if you go back into the system which is already existing, and if you have to put it, and then there are multiple layers. You had an end franchisee, you had a distributor in between, you had a super distributor, you had the entity, and if you have to calculate on a real-time basis, the right from a tax to margin that you're paying, it has a huge work.
Correct.
And you now again multiply it with the complexities of more and more services, more and more products being done on fly, it is a very completely different challenge. So right from a team to product, to kind of all the system changes.
Right.
And on top of that, to keep your team motivated and a marketplace educated enough to being able to deliver it has been one of the larger challenges in that time. And again, being from a cost center to getting into approach of being an independent company, managing your own financials and kind of charting your own course for the journey was a bigger challenge in that time. The second phase was pre-regulation. Again, there was a norms that we put in basis on our own knowledge. Then the regulation came in 2011, which was after Payment and Settlement Systems Act 2007. And we had to gear again our entire system to get regulated, work differently as an entity. Though, thankfully, we were always well governed. So we could also contribute a lot to policy making at that time, along with RBI. So that was a different phase where we had to gear up. I mean, we were already a credible player, but also in eyes of regulators, the similar status that, yeah, these are credible entities to be given license.
Correct.
And work as a... as a regulated entity. We were the first one with that, again, being a retail space to get the license. So that was the second phase. And from there, working continuously with regulator to expand the business and still continue the business. And it was a mix. You had a business which was directly regulated. You had some pieces of business which were not regulated. So again, balancing within that. And by the time, as we were kind of looking at the capital, the people, the technology, all of those three levers moving in cohesion.
So, Naveen, when you look back on the journey of building ItsCash, for you and the team, what were one or two of those interesting inflection points or breakthrough moments in which you believed that it took the organization to the next level?
So, I think post Dish TV, our next big thing was actually railway ticket booking, where again, which were the first non-bank entity who...
That
enabled
would be IRCTC.
IRCTC.
Perfect.
So that was the big inflection point. And for a long period of time, we remained number one as a non-bank payment player. And even for a longer period, we were between top three player with all the bank, non-bank, with all the debit, credit card and all other tools still proliferating along the sideways. So we continue to be the dominant market leader in that space. Amongst the non-bank, we were always the largest in that segment. So that was one. Parallel to that, there has been utility bill payments. There has been multiple instances where we were the largest market shareholder, be it with BACS in Delhi, Reliance Energy, again from a both bank and non-bank digital payment collection perspective. Similarly, there are one or two more examples. The corporate solutions, like you mentioned, Amway, there were a few more set in microfinance. Okay. There has been some interesting case studies, completely unique, still not known to the world, but we were the largest player in that segment as well, and very successful and a very large, both from a volume revenue and even profitability perspective. So these were some of the products. And lastly, I think we were the only entity, again, who came out first time with a bank partnership and a network branded cards,
right,
which were not only being accepted in digital space, but also accepted on ATMs and as well as all the physical merchant locations which had a POS. So we used to call it, it's exactly like a debit card without needing a bank account. So even if you don't have a bank account, you can get this card which will work like your debit card. It's almost like your bank in your pocket. And we were the again, first one to partner with, again, very eminent banks like SDFC and many such IndusInd. There were many other banks that we were working with, RBL, mm-hmm. and all of them had very interesting products.
So tell me something, creating a category is always extremely difficult.
Yeah.
All the more reason when you're first or one of the first through the market. So how do the consumers first react when they heard of this thing called a prepaid card?
Well, you will be, I wouldn't say completely surprised, but you'll find it odd that consumers never care for about payment products.
Sure.
The only thing they understand after so many years are only two things, probably to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Cash and credit card to some extent, which is still very small. A little bit of a debit card now. Otherwise, in their mind, the payment as a product doesn't exist.
Correct.
Payments are never an end, they are means to an end.
Perfect.
So they always look at the end game. And for payment player to be successful, you just have to silently embed yourself into the end game of the consumer. So we never really needed to educate too much consumers about what this product is.
Okay.
All we said that if you want to pay a DISH TV subscription, this is how we would do it. And by the way, this happens to be the product. If you want to pay that donation through a text, again, by the way, very few people know, across the globe, we were the only company and the first one who could even do text to pay.
Correct.
In those many years, or on a voice. So we just always say that if this is your transaction you want to do and these are your problems, you could do it this way. And they understood it, because if it is solving a problem, train ticket, it was very simple. If you don't have a debit credit card or a bank account or don't know how to use it, you want to book your train ticket in 10 minutes.
Correct.
Here is the solution. So you always had to go to them, try and explain what problem are we solving and how it is getting solved. Not all of them tried, but those who tried, they really got delighted, and this is how it spread. And this is how they start talking to others, educating others, that, hey, why the hell? I mean, you should just use this.
So tell me, Naveen, for some consumers, when you talk about money or cash,
yeah,
it's very closely associated with a bank.
Yep.
That means anything to do with money or cash,
yeah,
I need to see a bank in the picture somewhere.
Yeah.
So how does a brand like It's Cash solve that conundrum or a challenge in a consumer's mind?
So I think two ways it solved the problem. I think what you're talking essentially is that how do you solve problem for trust?
Perfect.
Bank and cash are synonymous of trust.
Correct.
Right? Cash because of the government backing, RBI, banks because of the way they are licensed and regulated. So we had to solve it with an equal trustworthy brand, which had to be by your conduct, which had to be by your lineage. Thankfully, we were part of a large group, which had by then already a track record of doing these innovative things successfully. So there was that confidence in people that if it is coming from this group, this will work. So we had that unfair advantage over many others. And we leveraged it in a very subtle way, at least wherever we could. Also, we always associated with partners who were always seen trustworthy, like IRCTC. So if they are saying that work with them or you can use this, it's good. If there is an entity where I'm already working with, if that entity I trust and if that entity is trusting them, then this works. For example, Amway, if you go to their customers, they don't know us. But if Amway is telling them that, okay, this is a vehicle, then that is. So we always use this as a strategy rather than going and burning truckloads of money just on building that trust. So we solved it this way.
So tell me something, Naveen, assuming that I am a young business and I'm just starting off, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to get my first deal or a sale. I could be trying to sell something either to a business or to a consumer, right? And I'm trying to open my cash register. Any tips in terms of how I can build trust to get my first few sales coming through?
It's very simple. I mean, there are two ways you build trust.
Sure.
First, you have to do what you say. And you have to be honest about your products, good, bad, and ugly things. It's never about one thing. I mean, it has challenges in short run, but in a long run, it always works. Be consistent, be honest. And when you go, you always do your homework that why should that person? I think it's more about homework.
Sure.
When you just walk across and just try and market and sell, oversell without understanding what I'm solving for and why should he buy this product or why should he take this service from me, then it will never work. He will not respect you. If he doesn't respect you, it doesn't build trust. I mean, trust is even a second level. It starts with first, he trusting you that this guy has done his homework, he's prepared, he understands what I really need. And then you present a product with all its goods and bad and ugly thing. He will know that you're a sincere person. And with that sincerity, if he gives you an opportunity, you execute to that sincerity. And trust me, even if you fail, you will still have that trust. People feel that if you fail, you will lose the trust. That's not the case. You lose trust when you say X and then you do Y.
Sure.
Or you promise the moon and you actually remain on Earth. You don't have to actually.
So you said something very interesting, right? So what you're saying is it's extremely important to share what can go wrong as well.
Yep.
In that dialogue.
Absolutely.
And which I think I agree with you. I don't see enough conversations, at least the first round conversations, where people are honest and bold enough to say, this is what I think can work, but these are the things which I don't know or may not work. Can we be prepared for it?
So this is linked back to the homework.
Sure.
If you have done your homework well, which means you know that while these 10 things can go wrong, but these 20 things will still go right and a net of that is still beneficial, then you will never have a worry. When you have not done that homework, you will ignore those 10 things. You'll only focus on that 20 thing that you know, which leaves that room open. And then if that 10 things or even 2 things happen, it leads to a surprise on the other side, and those people start losing trust in you. But if you have said upfront that these are the issues, and probably this is how we can control or mitigate the risk, that is actually appreciated. And then things that you said has happened anyway, so that works in your favor.
So taking you forward on things can go wrong, in the It's Cash journey in specific, can you tell me one incident or one thing where something really crashed and burned?
Well, they were not completely crash and burn, but there were many products which we launched and we thought will probably hugely scale or will be like a huge success, and they didn't happen. A couple of them very quickly. One was a very large technology institute right in Bombay, heart of Bombay, very prestigious one. We tried to do a cashless campus with them.
Okay.
With again a very prestigious partner, a network, a complete NFC, contactless, phone based as well as a card based.
Wow.
Somehow it didn't work, and we were trying to make it work with just the cashbacks, and we realized that it's not sustainable because students won on the whole. And I've seen this actually in general in India, that a lot of people focus the payments and these financial product on students.
Sure.
Other than the student loans, everything else actually is not a great proposition.
Right.
Unless you're really thinking 10 years plus. And we realized that they don't have deep enough pocket to make it sustainable.
Sure.
And also they're all used to a credit. So what they really needed was a credit product instead of a prepaid product.
Correct.
So they used to just going and that guy just telling him, this is your balance, he'll pay as and when go. So that experience versus you still have to load and then pay even if it is cashless, I think there's a huge gap. I think the value proposition is very different. So that's something which was a learning, and we actually sincerely withdrew over a period of time. 3 years we tried and then we realized it's not something that will work. Same way we work with a large municipality, one of the largest metro. We thought that a lot of things will work on it. It will become almost like Octopus Card.
Sure.
And it continued to work for 3 years for some of the tax collections, entry points seamlessly. Some 30,000 plus vehicle were using it 24/7. But we realized expanding it in an environment the way the municipalities and government works and making it viable, and we had a bank partner, and without the commitments from all of it, it becomes a loan fight, which doesn't give you enough reward for the time effort. And when you're an entrepreneur, you have a limited capital. Whatever it is, it's always be limited and limited bandwidth. You have to use it very wisely, whether it's a time or capital. So we withdrew.
So if you were to look back on your journey with Itzcash, if there was one thing that you think you would do differently,
yeah,
what would that be?
To be honest, I thought through a lot about this one. For Itzcash, fortunately, not many things. That's or actually not much. Maybe
so
because
immortality.
I don't know, but maybe because we had, see, I've been an entrepreneurial journey about for 20 years, and we had multiple businesses in and around Itzcash.
Sure.
And probably we made enough mistakes in those. One was, which was just chatting briefly, that overdoing, you know, and then what is really material for the customer, rather go with it.
Correct.
So, you know, we made enough mistakes. There would be probably smaller things, but it's other way around. Sometimes for a small period, we regretted that we didn't do this right. But in a longer term, actually, that became a boon. I mean, including, let me give an example. I think our payments bank strategy, the way we applied and we thought we would get the license for certain things that we ignored, we didn't get it.
Mm.
But the reality is it actually became a boon for us. Okay. We actually focused on profitability. We became profitable. We exited.
Sure.
So in today's context, there's no regret. Maybe for that brief period, it looked like that, hey, we missed something here.
Awesome. Every business needs capital, right? And I know that you have raised money from some really prestigious firms. But I'm sure, who was your first pitch to for raising funds outside of the SL Group?
Sure.
And how was the first pitch?
So thankfully, it was the other way around. I mean, we had a tradition where we never had to look out for capital in our early days. Because as I said, our journey started as a cost center. We were provided capital. We were actually profitable.
That's right.
And we never thought that we need money.
Sure.
And I should thank, and I can name them because they deserve it. I think I should thank Sequoia, who actually came and educated us that why there is a merit in taking outside money and why work with a VC firm like that. So I still respect and both our good friend SK Jain and Mohit Bhatnagar. They actually spend considerable time with us, educating us that how do we work on it. And actually, it's with their guidance I pitched. So it's not even that as if I pitched. My pitch used to be very simple those days. I used to just demo my product on a phone that, hey, just send this 11 rupee donation to Siddhi Vinayak. And that used to be most of it. I mean, that works, and that delight of getting the message back, and if you paid some more money, getting even a prasad at home was a huge, awesome fulfillment that you could see. So thanks to them, they were the one who actually educated about it. At the same time, we were in touch for that time with Intel, and somehow Metrics team led by Avnis probably hit a goal. They moved very fast in the last lap, and then we ended up working with Intel and Metrics.
All right. So they're like you, they believe in speed, so I think both of you clicked.
Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned that external capital has a certain value.
Yeah.
So apart from the fact that it's hard cash, what is the value that it brings to a business or it can bring to a business?
Actually, for us, the value has been entirely beyond capital.
All right.
And that's the reason we even considered it.
Sure.
So take example, why did we choose to work with Metrics and Intel? It was very simple. We were in a business which was dynamic and it was completely dependent on digital. The person coming from Metrics on our board was Avnis Bizaz. And it's very simple that you're getting a person who has walked through that journey, who has amazing credentials, both academics, right from Harvard to everything, to an entrepreneur.
Correct.
If you ever were to hire a person like him for your guidance, it's going to be hugely expensive.
Sure.
But if you have a person like him who's willing to work with you, mentor you, help you, and also give you capital, it actually has a tremendous value, who will connect you into the ecosystem wherever you can't, plus help you make lesser mistakes. So it's not just Avnis, even the other board member that we had, we chose very wisely that in a journey where you don't know where the path will take you, it's important to have people who will reduce your number of mistakes. That's what you could do, and that's where you save a lot of capital and you create better value.
So you worked with some marquee investors, which I think very few have that experience in India. Any tips about once the funds come in, how should you formulate or mold a relationship with the investor? What are the dynamics like? Any tips?
See, one rule always works, and which we followed in our boardroom. So in our boardroom, I was the person who was the executive and balancing for the management and the entire company. On the other hand, we had promoters. And then on the other hand, we had independent directors. Plus, we also had investors.
That's right.
And we realized that they all bring in different perspective, which is very valuable, but their thought process will always be different.
Correct.
But to bind it all together, there was only one rule. If it is good for the company, it is good for everyone. If it is good only for just one or two or three of you, but not good for the company, it can't be any ever good. So the ultimate litmus test was very clear. If it is good for the company, everybody will support it. And that's how you would, even if you had to even argue on that, you would argue and say that, hey, this is not good for the company, even if it is what you want. So we can't do it. But if it is good for the company, ultimately everyone understands that. If what is good for the company, it will always work because it takes care in a longer term. I mean, I think all the concerns of everybody.
Right. I want to then move to the other dimension of your journey. You were very instrumental in setting up the Payments Council of India. What was the trigger point for setting it up?
So it was an interesting, I would say, a turn in my journey. It was also very early days. It's almost like, again, 2007-8. We started that journey as a small committee within Internet and Mobile Association as a payments committee. I think the instrumental was very simple, that as a non-bank, we realized that if we are going to get regulated by RBI, and if you have to go and talk to them on the similar issues as individual entities, one, it actually creates a very murky picture because everyone's communication is different. We all know about Chinese whispers, right? That becomes a big challenge. And then the outcome of that is going to be a very trickier one. So we realized that unless we go as a group and we align our views and then sit with regulators, we would not really get our voice heard, or we will not really be able to achieve what is right for the country, for the industry, for the players and for the regulators also in the longer run. But that required again a work at the larger industry level. And we realized that somebody has to do it. And since we were the pioneer in this space, especially prepaid instrument, which was about to get regulated at that time, there was already a small committee around payment aggregators, but they were not the ones who were being looked at being regulated, or let's say very tightly regulated. But we knew that prepaid space will definitely get regulated.
Sure.
So it was imperative for us to create that sort of a group of people, an industry place or an association where people can come together, discuss their core issues and the approach to discuss it with regulator. Also to build credibility in their mind that this is not one or two, you know, entrepreneurs or startup or a kid just trying to do something without understanding. So we also had that responsibility to take back to the industry and make sure they are kind of educated enough to do that conversation.
For some people who may not be as familiar with the Payments Council of India, to your mind, what were some of the key things where the PCI actually helped the larger industry?
I think it started from every bit of regulations in the payment and fintech ecosystem, starting from the regulation of prepaid guidelines. Even the first draft guidelines, there was extensive dialogues and the discussions and contribution from the industry forum, of course with help and support of RBI itself. That way they are very progressive, and there's a continuous dialogue. So started from there, then even a registry process for aggregators, and there has been series of regulation coming in, and I can name some of them. BBPOU, mm-hmm. So where again I was invited as industry chair to participate even in the core committee, which proposed eventually the formation of BBPOU called Gyro Committee, led by Sri Padmanabhan, who was the ED at that time. We also had multiple changes within regulations, like remittances being allowed on prepaid. We had multiple committees, like there was a Vatul committee to create a framework for the entire payment systems. And again, we were invited to contribute where we could discuss openly what are the challenges the industry faces and what should be the approach. I think to some extent, which is yet to happen fully, but I guess at least the chair of the committee, and it is part of the report now, that they understood that payments could be actually the horse to drive digital payments, or rather non-bank entity or a payments entity versus banks. Banks could be the cart now in today's context. It doesn't have to be other way around. So that's kind of a role we were playing with them.
Got it. Contrary to popular belief, I have always believed, and I think so do you, that the Reserve Bank of India is possibly one of the most progressive regulators. Across any category globally. What do you think has helped them to not only start being progressive, but to constantly remain progressive? What do you think they're doing right?
I think it's always about communication. Communication in their own global community, participation in those global forums where they are already members, like BIS, right. And there are many such forums or FATF. I think we as a country are very progressive. We are members of most of those forums and we continuously contribute and learn. So that's one part. And secondly, the dialogue process. So most of the positive outcome has come wherever things have happened in detailed discussion between the industries and all the key stakeholders. And the only occasions we had some hard buns is where some of the things has been, for whatever reason, done in an ad hoc basis, either side.
Sure.
So most of the success that is there today is because of this communication, dialogue, and open and a transparent process.
Many leaders need to interact and get work done with or collaborate with regulators.
Yeah.
Any tips? What worked for you?
I think we were always successful whenever we could reach a combined conclusion on a certain messaging and certain discussions or certain issues. And that has always worked. There has been occasions I have seen in my 12-year journey in the industry as it has been growing that there has been outlier who thought that this is not good for the industry but good for me, so let me go and against the industry and try and do it.
Right.
Trust me, I've seen the occasion where they had to turn back in a few years and realize that if it is not good for the industry, it may be good for me in a, let's say, immediate or a short term. It is never going to be good for me in longer term. It's just that I still need to explain this to a lot of newcomers who have good success, who are very good entrepreneurs, but they keep forgetting this. Sometimes, and let me use this word, in their excitement and arrogance, they think that we are bigger than the industry. And if it works for us, we don't care about others. That never works.
Right.
And most of the time we were successful that out of 10 times, 8 times at least, we would reach a common consensus on common issues and our common position. And that's where we have always got benefit.
So sitting as we are in 2019, which is precisely 18 years from the time that IRCTC first started their transactions, how do you see payments in India today? Are you happy with the progress made? What's your view?
So I'm a balanced guy. I think it's still half glass, half full and half empty. So if I look at a very macro picture, I think thankfully we have all the infrastructure in place,
right,
from
in
terms of technology capable man and general infrastructure about connectivity, etc., are continuously improving, whether it's even in rural areas or everything else. The product side, the rails, roads, like whether it's UPI, whether it's IMPS, even the card network products, all exist. Policy framework is something which is evolving continuously and remains a challenge. And that's where a lot of tug-of-war keeps happening between banks, non-banks, and sometimes regulators. Because regulators need to, again, create a balance. And within creating balance, before you reach that fine balance, you always have some tilt either side. So that's a process we are in. I think yesterday only I was just churning some statistics for some other discussion and I realized that if you look at the pure play electronic or digital payment in the retail segment,
right,
without the check payments, we've grown just in the last, March 2019 report, if you see, you've grown over 36%.
All right.
Which is one of the highest across the globe.
And in absolute numbers, how much would that be?
It would be, I think monthly basis, we are doing about $250 to $230 billion worth of transactions in just the retail only.
Correct.
Right. And if you look at the entire system, which includes the wholesale, the systemic payments and the RTGS and everything, probably you're talking upward of $2 trillion worth of transactions on a monthly basis.
Wow.
So it's nowhere as small, but our challenge is this retail piece.
Right.
It's hugely voluminous.
Correct.
And the growth there is very rapid, but if you compare it with the entire cash in the economy,
right,
it's back to where it was pre-demonetization. It's just about $2.1 trillion
right,
on a fortnightly basis.
Correct.
And it's still growing. So when you look at that and then you look at this $250 billion number, you realize you're still like less than 10-12%, you know, or kind of around that. So that remains a challenge that for us to be a digital society and for us to be a real developing or a developed economy, our digital payment transaction has to be around 40-50%. And that's the aim we are trying to do. Like even RBI rightly said that it will never be cashless, it will be less cash. And for us, less cash is then at least up to 50% digital. So that's the journey we are, and I think that's an opportunity that remains. But as I said, that most of the things are in place. Hopefully with this policy things and the regulators and the industry, we will find the right balance to continue to grow this growth.
So if I'm a business in India or I'm just a hardworking person working in a state government job today,
yeah,
why should it really matter to me whether payment penetration is 5% or 50%? How does it impact the common man?
So, very indirect answer, but very macro level. If you look at economics, I mean, ultimately, society is about larger economic good and some economic value being created for whatever you do. And they are all interconnected, whether you like it or not. Very simple thing. In an economy where the society is gradually becoming digital, and if your money, as per the economic student, has been told that money is like a blood flow in a body which is like an economy. So imagine if you are a physical body which is moving like a digital, and then your blood is still moving like a physical, you'll get a heart attack.
Right.
And for it to avoid, you have to maintain the pace of that digital. And that can happen only with digital.
Correct.
So this is one which is the reason it has to happen. The second, every time you move velocity of money, your growth in an economy actually has a very positive impact.
Correct.
Take an example, even in stock market. Every time, and I don't remember the statistics, but anyone can check. Every time they cut down their transaction settlement cycle from a T plus 4 to 5 to 3 to 1 and now T plus 1, I guess, the volumes have grown.
Right.
It's a very simple analogy that more digitized you do, the velocity of money increases. More velocity increases, your growth in the economy becomes faster. Because your money remaining ideal, the period for which it is ideal and the quantum which is ideal reduces. Which means it is more productive. When it is more productive, when the economy is growing, everybody will grow.
And in the same breath, if you reduce the friction,
yep,
it enables commerce to be much simpler.
Exactly.
Perfect. So, my favorite topic. Payments is an extremely regulated industry.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the reality of it.
Yeah.
There have been a spate of recent either recommendations or announcements. One was the entire thing on Aadhaar. Then a more recent one on a zero merchant discount rate. Or for some listeners, where they basically said there will be no transaction fee. What's really happening? Because if businesses need to exist in the payment space, processing payments, making it happen.
Yeah.
And we all agree, and everyone seems to agree, that payments is a critical backbone. Some of these are just contradicting.
Yep.
So, what's happening? Can you help us weave through this maze?
So, every healthy person never remains healthy, right? They also get sick. So, sure. These are some of those symptoms that you as an industry also sometimes get sick because of some bacteria or a virus. I mean, pardon me for saying it that way, but see, there are always contradictory views and there are always bigger issues that sometimes a government or a court has to decide on.
Correct.
And sometimes some minor overlooking here and there, or some ignorance, or maybe some reasons which is probably not known to us. The intentions are different, but the implications that come out or outcome becomes different. Take example of Supreme Court. I think the focus was data privacy, and rightly so. They wanted to protect interest of a consumer's data.
Yes.
And they've done it very well. I guess the belief in the verdict that everything non-government is about leaking the privacy and everything government is good was a wrong premise. Because the reality also is, if you look at with the facts, the more data leakages has happened from the government portals and where the data was lying unprotected. I'm being very direct here.
Sure.
Right? So this premise has led to this problem. While it could have been very simply, I mean, for some reason, whether it occurred to them or not, or maybe there was some confusion. What you needed to simply do is that all regulated entities who by regulation need to do KYC should have been simply given access, comment or non-comment. Anybody who doesn't need to do KYC as per regulation, they should have been spared.
That's right.
If they would have just done this correction, the word instead of government and non-government versus regulated or covered under PMLA versus non-PMLA.
Right.
Should have solved everybody's problem. Now we're trying to rectify it, but the course of rectifying is pretty long. It's going back to the parliament. Then also, while we're doing it bits and pieces. It has happened first for the telco, then for the bank. I think somewhere there, the leap of faith is required that if you're regulated by RBI, whether you're a bank, non-bank, you're regulated. More or less, there are same norms. So somewhere we need to have that leap of faith that if you're a digital economy, then we as well allow all these entities.
Sure.
Who by regulations are required to do it. Like I said, sometimes there is a difference in what you say and what you think and what you really believe. I think that needs to really change and say that, hey, and I also give this example in Aadhaar context, even for banks. When you allow Aadhaar as a KYC, Very few people talk about it. I don't know why that's valid only for 12 months, which means in 12 months you have to do physical.
Correct.
I think we need to completely let go of those old thought process and legacy issues, that if it is done digitally, it's done.
Correct.
We have full faith. If it is a government system, if we trust the system, at least allow them to fully ride on it.
That's right.
So these, those nuances, I think as we fix, I think it will have a huge kind of an impact, positive impact. Last on MDR, actually, we're still trying to figure out where it has come from.
Sure.
And how it has come, or is it an error? For two reasons. One, we had extensive dialogues with every possible committee and the people who were working, not only in budget, but also specific in area of payments, whether it's an Andan committee, whether it's a Vatal committee, and in between more committees.
Sure.
Including consulting discussions that were invited by, let's say, government and departments before the budget. Nowhere this issue came up about being MDR being zero. In fact, everywhere the discussion was that, yeah, efficiency should be increased wherever possible. The distribution of MDR between issuer and acquirer needs to be fixed. Even Nandan committee recommended it very clearly, that the bigger problem today in payments is increasing the penetration of merchant acquiring side. And for that, we need to have more reward for those people. Simple economics principle, again, that you have to reward people if you want outcome. And that is what was the recommendation. And left, everything else was said that leave it to the marketplace to decide the pricing. So actually it came in as a shock. Because of this consultation, it never came. Second part was that this is actually applicable for merchants who are above 50 crore of a turnover.
Right.
Which actually are already digitized.
Correct.
So we're still not able to understand that, is there an error? Shouldn't it have been, if at all, below 50 crore? Who probably need to be penetrated.
Sure.
So we are not able to understand, but because it has kind of gone through budget process, reversing is a bigger challenge, but we're working with the government, but we're not getting this clear answer to these two things. How can it be 50 crore and above? And when there has been extensive consultation, how did it come suddenly where there was no recommendation?
So somewhere we'll hope that it is just an inadvertent typo and someone figures it out.
We just hope so and gets fixed somewhere. It's just that fixing process again, like Aadhaar, is pretty long.
Got it. Alright, so I always had a glint in your eye when I have a conversation with you on this one. So which of those upcoming innovations or dimensions that you think can really influence the growth of payments in India?
So there are different areas. There are use cases and there are technologies.
Excellent.
If you look at technologies which are going to impact payments kind of in a huge impact way, one, of course, which has already happened, but we have still not seen full dimensional impact, is the overall blockchain, how it will impact the industry and industry players,
That's
the way
it.
They do account, the way they do the clearing and settlement.
Perfect.
On the other hand, we've already seen what a private cryptocurrency can do to a digital economy, and even to economies and even to the world. I think these two concepts or a combination of concepts is going to have a huge impact in the next 20 years.
Alright.
And I personally believe that the way communication and information was democratized by internet, I think currency can be democratized by some of those concepts.
Okay.
And not just local level, it's a global level. A lot of friction is just because there are multiple currencies and no seamless exchange and a let's say transfer of those.
In reality, something like that sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
But that would also mean many of the existing institutions, rules, processes might literally get demolished. Do you think it's real?
Well, it's yes and no, and you're always right. Most of the time you see barriers and friction only because of this belief of a lot of these people.
That's it.
In a longer term, if you think, actually, there are very few industries which were completely wiped out in the digital process. Those are very famous examples. But in many cases, actually, they have expanded the industry. They've created a new role. So it is actually always suitable for entities who are adapted to change, who are ready to embrace the change and work on it. But those who have fought it, they were actually only perished. So I think it's about time. We have enough history now to look at last two decades, what has happened. I think enough of those tape and CD examples. We all know what has happened. But the reality is today, the music industry is booming. The revenues are higher.
Sure.
The singers are happy. Today, even if I'm a novice singer, I can start earning revenue by
that's right.
So we have to look at the positive side.
Right.
That every time things have changed, they've changed and grown the industry into a bigger dimension. And those who changed their model have actually took benefit of it. Those who fought, they created friction for the new guys, but eventually they perished. So it's a choice that the industry and the regulators and the country and the players will have to take. That whether you start adapting and be ready or versus just keep fighting. There are use cases that will come.
Correct.
For which I think the payments will have to change completely.
Okay.
There are scenarios like Internet of Things.
Right.
Which could be right from a kind of driverless car to a drone to any of these, to maybe a electronic equipment which needs to start remitting money or do commerce directly.
Yes.
So I think current solutions may not be, let's say, adaptable to those or may need to undergo complete change. And there are tons of these new use cases. I mean, we can just have a separate podcast on it. But briefly, so there are fundamental technologies like, as I said, blockchain, crypto. There are things like AI, ML, and then there's again a list. And then there are use cases. You'll have to look at both and then see the implications.
Okay, so if I'm an entrepreneur in India today and I know two keywords,
yeah.
One is payments and the other is blockchain, what kind of a business line or use case should I be working on right now?
So it's very simple. I mean, depending on what problem you want to solve for.
Sure.
One lesson that we recently learned in one of our workshops with a very senior professor on blockchain is that in blockchain, don't try and solve for the entire value chain.
Okay.
Solve it for one block at a time.
Got it.
So if you are a blockchain payment, can you just solve it for one entity for their own accounting, their own reconciliations? I do remember that even in my previous organization, if I had to look at my entire system of like 10, 12 years, if I needed on a click a complete reconciliations of the entire system, that all the money coming in and going out, it was a Herculean task.
Sure.
But if you had blockchain kind of a system, hypothetically, you're supposed to achieve it on a real-time basis because all the block and chains are in place. So it gives you on a real-time basis all the reconciliations. So I think you need to go bit by bit. And within there, that can you take one product at a time and start building this. And then gradually go to another entity, and then build. So I think internet told us to go in a value chain approach, but blockchain is telling to go back to one block at a time.
Exactly.
And that change is actually taking time. Sure. We're trying to apply the same tactic, and that's why it's not working.
So unfortunately, blockchain seems to be a bad word in some circles right now. Maybe it's for lack of information or for other stuff that has gone wrong out there.
Well, it's, if you look at it, it's not just about blockchain. It's a simple Gartner hype cycle. It was on a hype cycle about 5-6 years back. It is now
right.
Coming to that plateau. And I think it will move to a productive cycle in the next 2-3 years. There are lessons that people have learned. Like I just told you that the way you were working in an internet environment. So you were working on a earlier silo way of one product at a time in a digital era. Then you, when the internet came, you were doing end to end. And as I said, going back to that style of thinking block at a time, not the value chain. I think those are the learnings that are coming in, and then people are trying to build solution. There are some interesting examples, like KYC is one area where you could do a lot bigger things.
Right.
And that's happening in many places on blockchain. So there are some areas where it has worked. There are many areas it has not worked. Also, there are some specific challenges around the speed at which it can work and the overall cost at which it can process.
That's right.
So as those are getting fixed as a cycle, I think it will take another 5-7 years, but in that, you'll solve all these problems.
So when Naveen looks at Indian payments in, let's say, 2025,
yeah,
what are those two or three things that you would like to see have happened by then?
2025, okay.
It's 5 years from now. That's
5 years from now. I guess, I mean, this is an analogy I used in some of the forums recently when I met when talking about future. Unfortunately, we are at a stage where we have to solve for a lot of legacy issues. Like we still don't have our public transportation on digital payments. We still don't have our full utility and bill payments on as much digital as we want. So there are very simple known issues that we have to fix. So it's like we are trying to do graduation. On the other hand, in this 5 years, all these new use cases will emerge.
Yes.
Where there's no solution, which is like your post-graduation. You know, so you have these IoT, you have these blockchain issues, you have this maybe space travel, and there are dimensions like those.
Sure.
The problem for us is that we need to make sure, or rather we have to, what I want to see is that we are able to do graduation and post-graduation within that 5 years. But there's no choice. We will have to do it.
Sounds good. So I'm going to move to your leadership, management style, and touching on your innovation experience.
Mm-hmm.
You have innovated like crazy, possibly more than I've seen in most leaders. Now, there's a romance to innovation, but the reality is there's many things that don't work out. How do you manage your team? Because obviously when something doesn't work out, the shoulders start drooping and people start doubting themselves. So as a leader, how do you manage failure yourself? And more importantly, how do you help the team navigate it?
So there were two principles. One, never be afraid of failures. with the condition that don't repeat the failures of the same type.
Got it.
Right? Or in a simpler way to say that you're all allowed to make mistakes, don't repeat them, especially the third time.
Sure.
After two times, we will look at it, observe it, reflect on it. As long as that intent and that principle is honored, we never bother.
Correct.
So that was one. That was a very clear. Now, second thing is that so every person who's going out and experimenting, they knew what they are up to. So I always call innovation is not an experiment or what looks glamorous.
Okay.
It is a way of doing something differently, which has a very positive outcome.
Got it.
In a quantum difference than what it was. It could be a very small thing, maybe just coming from here to there and experiencing from a non-AC to AC environment. It's those smaller things.
Right.
It doesn't have to be always glamorous. So if there is experience which is drastically different in any small thing, it's an innovation.
Sure.
And we always knew that if there is a quantum benefit to us as a company and our stakeholders, we were
right.
Fine. So those were the principles we always defined with the team. After that, we never tried to micromanage it. We let independent teams who were understanding these principles behind which opportunity they are going. And they were allowed to kind of try, win, lose, fail, or be successful. With the same principle, don't repeat it. It worked.
Whenever you innovate, change, transform, there are always some stakeholders where it's hard or almost near impossible. Any tips in terms of what has worked for you in moving the needle with those kind of people?
I would say that people are tough till the time you understand why they're tough and what is it that they want.
Okay.
So it again takes greater reflection at your end. That if you want somebody to change, what should be his driver or what is the reason he would change?
Right.
And while I gave you example of earlier product, which we had to discontinue, but let's say in that product we had like 20 stakeholders, right? From a driver to a person who was collecting the tax, to owner of the vehicle, to a corporation which was responsible. Each of those people, the driver for change or adopting a new product or a process was very different.
Correct.
Now, if he would go with one thought process and try and cut across them, then we will say, hey, these people don't want to change.
Sure.
The reality is that we have not presented them the reward for that change, what they are expecting or what they think. That is why it is not working.
Valid.
Yeah, sometimes some people may be completely tough, but that's rare. Most people are okay to change.
Sure.
The degree of incentive and the benefit could vary. You know, so some will with just 10% incremental benefit, they are very enthusiastic by nature.
Okay.
Some really needs to be presented that this is complete life-changing moment for you. So those are the assessment we as a businessman and entrepreneurs need to do, that why would you do it? At what level of degree of change will you really do it? And if you believe it's not going to happen, you as well withdraw, don't waste your time.
And
rather than cribbing later on that green book.
And does compromise go hand in hand with innovation?
Well, I wouldn't call it compromise. It's about resetting, right?
Okay.
I would say evolving, adjusting, resetting.
Alright.
I don't think compromise is a very negative term.
Fair.
I mean, if there is a space this much, you try to say that, okay, I have to squeeze in. You have to figure out a way to squeeze in. You can't just adjust or compromise. There's no way it will work.
Correct.
You have to find a way to squeeze in into that.
So payments is now called the industry for the big boys or the big bucks. Right? There are many brands out there and I think most of us know which ones.
Yeah.
How does a young team wanting to succeed in this space, and this is actually true for any industry,
yeah.
How do you go up against the big boys or the deep pockets and the big bucks?
Well, I think it's always about, we've all were taught that BCG metrics and many other matrices, but we don't really follow it when we do the business.
Sure.
Is that really back to those simple basics?
Okay.
That which is the market segment you're going to fight? Which is the market segment you should fight? Which is the market segment you will really own? So each of those so-called big boys or brands are very clearly probably that big boy in a particular segment.
Okay.
The reality is that the market is still, as I said, 10% digital, 90% has not happened. Within that 10%, again, let me demystify, this is not there. So-called big boys market share in that 30,000 crore monthly market share is just about 10,000.
That's right.
The other 20,000 is why the players were not as well known or as glamorous.
Sure.
They're actually doing bigger businesses and bigger revenues than many others. So I don't think they should try, as if they are going to do exactly what they do, the way they do, they will definitely fail. But if they find the market opportunity in the remaining 90%, where these guys don't have a capability, don't have a wherewithal, you pick up your market and opportunity right and just keep going about it without distraction, looking at here and there. When you're on a steering wheel, you have to look at forward, not, yeah, once in a while you can glance, but if you're looking there and then driving, you're doomed to give me an accident.
So after leaving this conversation with you and I head out of the room, if I were to ask you, which are the two or three segments I should go after? And this is linked to the previous question. Which one do you think I should go for?
It's very clearly underbanked.
Okay.
I'm not even saying unbanked. I'm clearly saying underbanked. These are people who have bank accounts, but they use bank account only for pure play savings or some emergency needs. And that's like almost 50% of the population. For payments, they are still need different motivations for a variety of reasons. And the customer who is still having his income received in cash. If you really go after them, they are the real large, big one that's like next 20-30% segment. Large volume.
Got it.
But scale and value-wise, probably way bigger than these guys. The top 10%.
And do you think it would need radically fresh thinking from the way that we're approaching it today?
Yes and
no. Or are we almost there?
Yes and no. I think you have to keep adjusting to these people's changing aspirations, these people's changing environment. But usually they move in change slightly slowly
in
the top 10%. So you don't have to worry too much, but you have to focus a lot about, I mean, I call approach called two words, omnichannel, which means you can't just have one channel with too many people, and technology with human touch. Use technology maximum, but these people have to be driven only by human touch in an interim period.
Got it. So Naveen, we move to our last section. So we call this a quick fire round. The only difference is you will not get a coffee hamper or a coffee mug.
Wow. Right. That I'll claim later from you, irrespective.
Anytime.
Yeah.
All right, so this is some random stuff. This
yeah.
just allows us to get to know you better. Okay. Mountains or beaches?
Clearly mountains.
The best book you've ever read?
Best book I ever read. Book of Secret. It's a translation by Osho of a very old ancient scripture called Kal Bhairav Tantra.
Okay.
Tantra, by the way, not kind of to avoid confusion, is science in our days. Nothing to do with what you think today.
Okay, I'll look that up. Favorite movie?
Two actually, Inception and Jerry Maguire.
Okay. If you can describe in three words, the worst person you had to work with ever in a professional environment, work-related.
Insecure. One word is good enough.
Insecure. And have you encountered that often?
Only in my first job, a couple of times, and thankfully I got wiser how to choose my company and bosses also.
I know which one you're talking about. All right. That's yet another podcast. Okay. Bungee jump or coffee?
Actually, both in any order is fine.
You will do a coffee when you're doing a bungee jump.
Either is fine.
I think you might do that.
Yeah. Do and then have a coffee or have a coffee and then do. Either is fine. Sequence is okay.
Together. Not together, right?
Together is not possible. If there's a way, we'll have to figure out.
Okay, long term or short term?
Actually, combined, very short term, which really settle wells into a long term. So it's actually long term fitting with short term.
Are you getting into politics?
No, it's right.
No, I'm just kidding. Take it.
Because actually, by doing any, either of this without combination, you're doomed for failure.
I know. I think what you're basically saying is having a vision. And then take
your short term has to fit it into your long term.
Into the long term.
It can't be other way around.
I agree. Culture or process?
Very clearly culture.
Great. Your winning mantra?
It's actually, I have a mantra. It's three words and a multiplication of them.
Okay.
It's called willpower or desire, multiplied with knowledge related to that work, and multiplied with work or action.
Wow.
It's an ancient mantra, by the way.
Okay. Play safe or go for broke?
Actually, it's again taking risk, but to a level where it won't make you broke.
Sounds good. The most exciting innovation of recent times, something which really got you saying, wow.
That's one gets me thinking. I think this is a combination of AI, VR, as well as machine learning, where you have seen a couple of interesting devices with which you could to combine entertainment. I mean, the real example, like for one example, there's a company called Braggy, which has come up with a headset which is touch operated, gesture operated, can work as a virtual assistant, can play your music, can store your music.
Which one is this?
Braggy, B-R-A-G-I. It's a German company.
Alright. Okay. The one thing you wish you had invented?
Interesting. Actually, time travel. Still time to do that.
So you read that, right? They got the first instance of teleportation.
No, I missed it.
A proton.
Wow.
So they got it from Earth to 300 kilometers outside the Earth.
Wow, so it's not far that much.
So not, I think we're getting there.
Okay.
Okay, the one thing you wish you could disrupt.
One thing I'll guess, physical cash.
Physical cash. No, no, tell me something beyond cash. We have talked about too much about money and cash.
Actually, we don't need to disrupt. I mean, my theory is that you create, you don't disrupt. When you create, there are implications.
Sure.
You don't do, you don't create to disrupt. It never works that way.
Okay.
Just because you created, sometimes things may get disrupted. If you do create to disrupt, it never works. I've never seen things which were created to disrupt and it worked.
Sounds good. The one thing that really bugs you?
The word that it is impossible. That's a sentence, actually.
I will keep that in my next meeting with you. The one thing which never really fails to give you goosebumps.
Roller coaster ride. On a big one, like Las Vegas.
Okay, that's on my bucket list. The main ingredient for success.
Actually, I gave the same mantra. It's a combination of your willpower to achieve, your knowledge that you acquire to achieve that, and your action that you're putting to achieve it. And I always say it's a combination of three. Just one missing won't work. Has to be all three.
Alright, and I know this is never going to happen, but an imaginary situation, the day when you actually hang up your boots.
Yeah.
Right? What do you think your professional epitaph
yeah.
would look like? What would it say?
It will probably say, here lies a man who knew who he is and what he wants in life.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Naveen.
Thank you.
Incredible pleasure as always, and look forward to, I think, two other podcasts with you.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
Avaaz.com.